What you know, what I'm more specialized in dogmatic theology, but I do work a little bit on Aquinas's, St. Thomas Aquinas's metaphysics and arguments for the existence of God and that kind of thing. So I'll tell you a little bit going into this talk, a little bit about Aquinas on pre-philosophical knowledge of God, and then talk about what proofs for the existence of God might even mean for at least St. Thomas and his approach. This is the kind of talk where if you've never heard any of this before, it could seem a little conceptually complicated, although I assure you it's quite masterable, or at least it's more approachable if you spend time with it. And if you've worked, it seems overly simplistic, and that's okay too. I mean, if you want to pose objections to things, either from non-religious or from otherwise Thomistic points of view, or if you have some ardent desire to defend St. Anselm of Canterbury, any of that, you know, I'm really open to an interesting conversation. I am going to read this paper, which will have the advantage of being clear and maybe the disadvantage of being dry, but we'll work through it, and I think it's about 45 minutes long. So let me start by talking to you about some of my presuppositions, just talking about this issue as a thinking human being. My first presupposition is that human beings, I think, can have real knowledge of God without having first proven the existence of God by philosophical measures. How that may be is itself an interesting question, but it seems that young children can pray to God, and of course I'm here presuming that God exists. It seems that children can say and know very profound things about God and say profound things to God. So there seems to be a pre-demonstrative knowledge of God that comes from intuitions about the world that we could call pre-philosophical or proto-philosophical, whereas philosophical demonstrations are more concentrated and intellectually focused ways of testing and refining our thinking about God so as to become more positively disillusioned in our conceptions of God, more realistic, more focused, maybe also more mystical. The second presupposition is this: demonstrations for the existence of God do not have as their primary aim to vanquish dissent or compel assent. There's nothing wrong with arguing against an atheistic position to try to show that it's unsound, but it is in the nature of this particular topic that it's quite difficult, and that therefore intelligent people can and often do disagree for an array of reasons, sometimes merely ideological, but often for very profoundly philosophical reasons. John Henry Newman, in his book, The Grammar of Assent, speaks of what he calls the illative sense, by which we embrace an overarching explanatory idea of reality. And he notes that we believe in explanations of reality, complex explanations, for not one, but a vast array of reasons, which is why when you know what a person believes about one thing, you may sometimes rightly infer what they are likely to believe about another. And our global consent to, say, either a religious or a non-religious view of reality is not built around one argument typically, but a whole strand of different intuitions and ideas, as well as arguments and emotional sympathies pertaining to truths that are philosophical, theological, scientific, historical, ethical, and aesthetic. We don't renegotiate our beliefs all at once, but rather through a constant sifting and reconsideration of a plurality of views in these various domains. So arguments for the existence of God are always contextual in the life of a given person, and typically they are also theologically embedded in history within a given religious tradition, be it Christian, Jewish, or Muslim. And this means that such arguments are rarely, I would say, theologically innocent, even if they may stand or fall on their own as rational arguments. I don't mean to say by this that these demonstrations or proofs are not, in the properly philosophical sense, demonstrations. They are meant to obtain concrete knowledge of God in the rational order. But they are embedded within complex human, psychological, and cultural conditions that affect all of us. And this is true also of culturally motivated atheists who make arguments that we should never say are merely specious arguments against belief in the existence of God simply because they are embedded within a larger scientific, political, and aesthetic context and culture. And so we can admit the complexity and at the same time really be interested in demonstrative argument. A third presupposition that's philosophical. The arguments that I'm going to examine here from Aquinas presuppose what we could broadly speaking call a realist turn of mind when speaking about entities around us. That's to say, I'm simply going to presume that the things around us and we ourselves truly exist in common and individually, that we have stable and identifiable natures, that no one here is about to mistake you or I for a houseplant, that we exert various forms of causality upon one another, such as speaking or writing or teaching or listening or thinking or conversations. Now, that is a modest claim that we have distinct existences, natures, and predictable causal activities. But we should know, and we do know, I think, that there are ways of trying to neutralize these very basic claims, and in their own sophisticated ways, David Hume and Immanuel Kant, each in different ways, seek to problematize some of these sharp claims I'm making by arguing that we do not have the kind of genuine metaphysical knowledge about individual human beings or natures or causalities that people like Aquinas think we do have. That kind of skepticism about basic metaphysics, you might say skepticism about metaphysics 101, and the adjacent skepticism to it of that of Friedrich Nietzsche and of people who are more deeply embedded in the postmodern tradition, are quite radical in kind, and they're not something I intend to engage with here. I am presupposing that the skepticism of these various authors is somehow mistaken and can be shown to be so, or at least argued against, based on prior and real knowledge that we do all have about existence, natures, and causalities, and which is imperfect knowledge but significant all the same. I'm very happy to talk about Hume, Nietzsche, and Kant in Q&A, but I'm just, for the sake of this presentation, going to presuppose these kinds of basic realist standpoints. It doesn't mean I think that, like, it's just obvious. That's not the case, but you can't argue about everything. So let me talk now about the second section of the lecture, having cleared the ground there, with some reflections on what I'll call here pre-philosophical knowledge of God. The mystery of God is not simply a question for people of a philosophical turn of mind. It touches on the intimate meaning of the question of what it is to be human, or at least it confronts us in some way with the discernment of the signification of our existence on a variety of levels. God, or the mystery of the divine, or the causality of the absolute that stands behind the world, seems to be at the periphery, if not the center, of every human civilization and of every human consciousness. Well, why would that be the case? The answer seemingly has something to do with our human nature. Now, St. Thomas Aquinas is famous for making arguments for the existence of God, but that are subtle and complex, and I'm going to look at two of them at the end of this lecture. But he also mentions in a variety of places a number of ways that, you might say, ordinary human existence, both through external and internal experience, confronts us with what we could call a numinous sense of the transcendent mystery of God. And this is what I'm calling pre-philosophical dispositions of the human spirit, or intuitions of the mystery of God. Aquinas names among these pre-philosophical dispositions, first, our experience of the order of the world, an order that remains in or amidst beings that change and which are interdependent, which makes the world predictable, seemingly stable, intelligible. In his commentary on the Apostles' Creed, Aquinas says that this experience of order in the world naturally raises the question of the cause of an ordered yet dependent set of realities. He makes a very simple, it was talks he gave for ordinary, non-literate people in a church in Naples. He says, it's as if you came into the house and you found heat. You would expect there to be a fire somewhere in the house that's the cause of the heat. So in the world, we encounter an order inscribed in things and that the things themselves are not the origin of. And that leads us to suspect that there is an ordering wisdom and cause of the world. Now, please note, I'm not arguing that this is not an argument for the existence of God. This is simply a raw experience that leads some people to an intuition that there may exist a God, or that there may exist a cause of the order in the world. And it could be argued against, right? The intuition could be illusory. That's not my point here, I'm not proving God's existence or something. I'm just talking about basic fundamental awareness of order and change in the world. Second, in his commentary on the prologue to St. John's Gospel, Aquinas mentions the basic human experience of time, finitude, and contingency, things coming to be and going out of existence. And this confronts us with our mutability and the basic mutability of all things. He says this naturally raises the question for the human spirit of eternity, or what remains, what lasts underneath and behind all that changes. Now, granted, Aquinas's example presupposes a medieval cosmology in which he thinks some physical bodies, namely the stars, are thought to be incorruptible. In a modern cosmological setting, we would now claim that such physical bodies are themselves also ultimately subject to generation and corruption, coming to be and extinguishing over vast periods of time. However, this new modern perspective would not nullify, but instead intensify the relevancy of Aquinas's argument. Third, Thomas observes that on a moral and voluntary level, human beings incessantly strive to find happiness and tend naturally to gravitate towards certain goods they think will procure happiness for them. For him, this raises the natural question of whether there exists a supreme good, a greatest good in reality, or whether there is anything that can finally satiate the human desire for happiness. He writes on this point in the Summa Contra Gentiles, I've given you this text, "Man naturally knows God in the same way as he naturally desires God. Now, man naturally desires God insofar as he naturally desires beauty, beatitude, or happiness, which is a certain likeness of the divine goodness. On this basis, it's not necessary that God considered in himself be naturally known to man, but only a likeness of God. It remains, therefore, that man is to reach the knowledge of God through reasoning by way of likenesses of God found in his effects." It's interesting. He's not saying the desire for happiness is some kind of immediate demonstration of the existence of God. In fact, he's saying something quite different. He's saying he thinks objectively that God exists and is the supreme good, but insofar as human beings inevitably strive to be happy, they find in a certain imperfect rest in various goods around them. That's the sign that they tend towards some kind of desire for fulfillment that can only ultimately and objectively be fulfilled by God. Finally, there's the question for Aquinas of being, or why things exist, or do exist, and this is the question of their origin. What is the cause of all that exists insofar as it exists? What is it that's necessarily first or primary in reality? The ground of all the rest, maybe it's just tiny particles of, you know, atomic elements that reconfigure, you know, cyclically through systems, but the point is that everyone can kind of formulate imperfectly. What is the first truth, that which is truest because it's the most explanatory with regards to everything else? This first truth is that which is most enduring in the causal order, in that, therefore, in explaining existence. Aquinas puts it this way in the Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 3, Chapter 25, a text I've also given you. "For each effect that he knows, man naturally desires to know the cause. Now human intellect knows universal being." You know, you can think about everything that exists. It doesn't mean you actually know everything exists. It means you have the scope of intellectual questioning, that you can reach out to ask questions about everything that could be or is. So he naturally desires to know the cause, which Aquinas tells us is God alone. Now a person has not attained his ultimate desire comes to rest. Therefore, for human happiness, which is the ultimate end, it is not enough to have merely any kind of intelligible knowledge. There must be divine knowledge as an ultimate end to terminate the natural desire. So the ultimate end of man is the knowledge of God. This text presupposes that he's already demonstrated the existence of God, which he spent a lot of time on earlier in this part of this same work. But his point is that there's a kind of striving for ultimate truth, truth explanations, that is animating human culture. This desire for the first truth is therefore intimately related to our natural desire for ultimate explanation, scientia in Latin, causal understanding of what is that which gives origin to all of reality. He continues along this line of thinking in chapter 25, and I've given you this also. "There is naturally present in all men the desire to know the causes of whatever things are observed. Hence, because of wondering about things that were seen, but whose causes were hidden, men first began to think philosophically. When they found the cause, they were satisfied. But the search did not stop till it reached the first cause, for then do we think that we know perfectly when we know the first cause." This is Aristotle, the ultimate cause of reality. "Therefore, man naturally desires as his ultimate end to know the first cause." So the ultimate end of man is the knowledge of God. I'm not naming any of these things in order to try to prove the existence of God. I'm simply saying that Aquinas is trying to identify ways that human beings have pre-philosophical dispositions through the medium of which they can think about the question of absolutes, the question of the ultimate cause of the world. Our experience of order in the world, our experience of time, finitude, and contingency, our striving for happiness and the corresponding goods that will allow us to procure it, and finally, our quest to know the immutable source of the existence we encounter in this world, all seem like genuine examples of places where human beings and human cultures do develop religious reflections. And it also seems to me important for people who intellectually and in an integral way or secular viewpoint to think about the alternative explanations to be provided to assuage people away from trying to find religious explanations precisely in these domains. They do seem to me like valid existential candidates for places of religious reflection. And so for those who want to work on the intellectual project the other direction, they seem to probably, I think actually Aquinas' observations are probably pretty interesting. But let me turn then to the matter at hand and ask, can one demonstrate rationally the existence of God? Now, for St. Thomas at least, and he only represents one avenue in the great Christian tradition and in the Catholic tradition even, there are many different views on this matter. And, you know, the Catholic Church, just as a matter of fact, doesn't require one to hold Aquinas' view. There are many different schools of thought that are all, as it were, enjoy the full rights of citizenship in the intellectual conversation. But for St. Thomas, that question, can we demonstrate the existence of God, depends on what we mean by rational demonstration. So now I'm going to turn to the third part of the talk, and I may actually slow down a little bit here because I want to get through the introductions and talk about a priori versus a posteriori demonstrations of God's existence. Okay, the basic questions for Aristotle of scientific explanation and demonstration, which he talks about in the Posterior Analytics, are the two questions, I put them in Latin, ansit and quid sit. Does it exist? Does a given thing exist? If it really is real, what is it? Aquinas thinks there's no real exception to this set of questions as your first questions you want to ask when you think about God, and begins even in the heart of his dogmatic theology in his famous work, the Summa Theologiae, which is a work about the revelation of God given in Christ, with this question in the second question of Summa, does God truly exist? And if so, what is God? What he does is he asks the question of whether God exists in question two, and in question three, when he begins on the divine attributes and talks about what's called God's simplicity, much misunderstood term, by the way, in our thinking. When he talks about God's simplicity, he says we will examine not so much what God, having argued that God exists, and we coming to the question of what God is, we will say more than what he is. So he does think that the structure of scientific reasoning obtains, but he turns more towards, you might say, to use the classic expression, an apophatic conception of God. When we speak of God, we speak especially of what we do not know of God, or what God is not in comparison with creatures. So as he enters into the philosophical question of whether God exists, Aquinas notes that according to Aristotle, there are two ways that one can approach the theoretical demonstration of this kind. The first way is by what he calls a priori, propter quid in Latin, by knowledge of the quid is thing and propter through the thing. So a priori, propter quid demonstration. And that first way would proceed from a knowledge of a given essence of a thing and its causes to a knowledge of its effects. I'll talk about this in a moment. But let's just say, for example, if you know what a human being is, you know a human being is capable of laughter. The other is the a posteriori quia demonstration, which proceeds from effects to their causes. And Aquinas sets forth this distinction. Well, I'll talk about this too. This is like you see smoke coming out of the woods and you infer there's something that is causing the smoke. For example, perhaps a fire. Okay, so a priori propter quid reasoning. In that form of thinking, knowledge of the essence of a thing as cause serves as the middle term of a demonstrative argument. Let me make one for you so that statement doesn't sound abstract in case you've never worked much in logic. All human beings are capable of laughter by virtue of having reason. But Socrates is indeed a human being. Therefore, Socrates is capable of laughter by virtue of being reasonable. Now, I may never have seen Socrates laugh, but because I know what human nature is, I know it is possible either by telling him jokes or perhaps tickling him to cause him to laugh. The middle term in my argument is the notion of humanity. We can engage in this form of reasoning because we have a knowledge, a priori, from the beginning, of the thing in itself, propter quid, of the essence of what it is to be human. That's to say, as a rational animal, we can define human being as a rational animal, capable of both intelligence and sensation, and therefore capable of laughter, because animals that are not rational cannot perceive the ironies of reason, but angels, which are not physical animals, cannot smile. Consequently, only rational animals that are both intellectual and sensible, neither angels nor animals, are capable of laughter. Now, the problem with using this kind of a priori reasoning to argue for God's existence is that we lack any immediate or intuitive knowledge of what God is in himself, or even, we might say, intuitive immediate knowledge, a priori, that God exists. His being or essence, you might say his definition, utterly transcends the limits of our finite human intellects. And that is why, according to Thomas, we cannot reason our way towards God's existence from these a priori definitional and deductive arguments of this kind. There are many, many analytic philosophers today who go the begin with nominal definitions of God in which they give you effectively what they consider to be the essential definition of God, and then go on to try to demonstrate it in one way or another as something that's real. Aquinas does not follow this pathway. In fact, when you ask the question of what God's existence is, Aquinas even problematizes from the beginning the use of the word. Isn't that interesting? This main doctor of the church who problematizes the very language of God from the beginning. It's not because he's agnostic, but as we'll see, it's because he thinks that there's all kinds of ways we can think we know more than we do when we start to talk about what we call God. Now, ultimately, this is why Aquinas will overtly reject the a priorism of St. Anselm's well-known so-called ontological argument written some centuries before. He does this in question 2, article 1 of the Summa in the first part, and I've given you a little text of that, too. Anselm had argued, in effect, that the notion of God, when you define God essentially, this notion includes the idea of a most perfect being. If you define what God is, then you know that God exists, for Anselm. That's really weird and interesting. Why is that the case? For St. Anselm, God is defined a priori as that greater than which nothing can be thought, the most perfect instantiation of being. God is that greater than which nothing can be thought, the greatest, the perfect instantiation of being. But he continues that it is most perfect for being to be real, then it is more perfect for being to be real than merely an idea. Therefore, the reality of a most perfect being would follow from the very notion of God, since that notion includes something that is most perfect. Huh? It's more perfect. I have the idea a priori of something most perfect that it can exist. It's more perfect to really exist than to just be an idea, so it must be real. In short, if we can conceive of God essentially as a most perfect being, greater than which nothing else can be thought, then God exists. Aquinas counters by saying that such notional definitions only get us to the mere idea of a most perfect being that exists necessarily, but do not yet constitute a demonstration or proof that any such being actually exists. In other words, Anselm has not been able to justify the leap from conceptual to extramental reality. We cannot demonstrate the existence of God simply by beginning from a nominal definition of his essence. We could note in passing that Aquinas' arguments are not like those of Descartes that derive from those of Anselm, and which many modern philosophers, namely Immanuel Kant, argue precisely against. So there's a whole like wing of argument that, and it has different forms, it's very complicated, much debated, but Anselm, Bonaventure, certain arguments in Scotus, then taken up by Descartes, Malebranche, Leibniz, argued against by Kant, argued against by Feuerbach. That whole highway of pro and con, Aquinas is not on that highway. He's just not going down that road. Aquinas' demonstrations for God's existence, on the other hand, are all a posteriori quia demonstrations, which seek to proceed from a known effect to an unknown cause. A known effect to an unknown cause. Now here the process passes from the created order, which is perceived precisely as dependent or in some way caused, or things within the order around us are perceived as caused, to the demonstration that there must exist a source of that order and of the things in that order and of the effects in that order. The goal with this procedure, I'm going to explore this at length. The goal of this procedure is precisely not to grasp intuitively what God is, but only to establish that God exists and to begin then to sow the seeds of ways we can think about so-called divine attributes, what God is not and what we might say of God's, say, eternity or perfection. So put differently, the goal is to demonstrate the undergirding rational intelligibility for our use of the word God and the ultimate explanation for the fact that the world exists in the way that it does exist. In effect, we're asking, what's the indirect but real evidence that there exists a first cause of all that exists, which human beings tend by cultural convention to call God? Now, in a posteriori quia reasoning, knowledge of the essence of the thing concluded to is not given. It's known indirectly from effects it produces. The notion of a reality as a cause of an effect plays the role of the middle term in the logical argument instead of an essential division, this definition of that cause. So remember, I used man can, human nature is rational animal, and I used the argument that all things that have rational, all rational animals can smile, Socrates is a rational animal, therefore Socrates can smile. The middle term is the thing allowing you to make the logical sequence of argument as valid and sound. And that middle term in that case was human nature as rational animal, which we have knowledge of a priori. But take another set of arguments. There is smoke coming up. We see it. There is smoke coming up from the trees. And then our next argument, our next affirmation, judgment. This smoke is clearly an effect of something, which is not the trees, because trees don't cause smoke, and therefore implies a cause of the smoke that doesn't come from the trees. Okay? Therefore, there must exist a cause of the smoke other than the trees. It's a pretty straightforward form of a posteriori reasoning. We conclude, for example, that there must be a fire or something like a fire causing the smoke, but we haven't actually experienced the fire. It could be something else. We don't know what. At this point, we still do not know what the cause is in itself, but we do reasonably assert that such a cause of smoke exists, which is not coming from the trees, something other than the forest. The middle term of this a posteriori reasoning was the perception of a cause vis-a-vis its effect, the effect being smoke. The realities that we know essentially, a priori, the trees, cannot cause the smoke, therefore a priori, a posteriori, quia, through in Latin, through the effects we perceive there is a hidden cause. Now, of course, it's a different kind of thing when you're talking about God, because it's not a fire in the woods, but I'm just trying to give you a kind of simple example of this form of reasoning. Now, based on this type of approach, we have no a priori definition of God in the strict sense, philosophically speaking. We may have common notions of a first cause from our basic intuitions I talked about earlier, pre-philosophical ideas about God, such as the idea from the order of the world of a possible first source of order. Likewise, we may have a complex narrative-based ontological notion of God as creator from religious traditions or from divine revelation. We don't have to come to the question purely innocently with regards to the idea about God. But philosophically speaking, we should acknowledge that our notional definition of what we mean by God is determined by first beginning with the realities we know immediately and analyze them as caused effects in the ontological order, in the order of being. From this analysis, we can raise the question of the necessary existence of a cause we do not know immediately, but only immediately and indirectly. So by God, we simply mean the cause of X, where X stands for some kind of determination in the order of being found in creatures that we can identify through our common experience and that simultaneously signifies causal ontological dependence, calling out for a first cause of its being. And if what the religious traditions call God truly exists, then God is, so Aquinas will argue, and here I'm just going through the five ways, noting things. God is the ultimate cause of movement and change in all the realities we experience around us. I said ultimate cause. Or the cause of the existence of things, or the truly necessary being who is the author of all contingent beings, or the source and measure of the hierarchy of perfections we find in reality in the order of being, truthfulness, goodness, unity, and so forth, or the intellectual source of the teleological order, the action in view of predictable perfections and outcomes that we find inscribed in all things. This is the kind of reasoning Aquinas uses in the five ways. The reasonings grounded in the search for a principle of ultimate explanation. The realities around us are in various ways effects of other realities, you and I are included. So we invite these realities that are dependent in the order of being invite us to ask the question of first fundamental origins. What if all the realities we experience are caused? What if they cannot explain themselves as existing because they point towards other things that cause them to be? It will be seen to follow from this that they all have a cause that's as yet unknown, but one that must exist as something different from all the caused realities, precisely so as to explain their collective existence. And this primary reality cannot be a being like the rest. It has to be a cause and origin that's not dependent on the others, lest we end up with an infinite regress that keeps us from having a sufficient explanation of the world. In each of Aquinas's a posteriori quia demonstrations, then, there's basically a logical structure that's similar in kind. I'm going to pass then to the first way of the five ways and read you the basic argument there. So in beginning with the, so I'm going to look at the first way, which Aquinas says is based on what's most manifest, which is that things around us are undergoing processes of change in which they're changed or moved by other things. Now, when he says everything is moved by another, he talks about movement. We tend to think in post-Newtonian terms about billiard balls, say, pushing each other around on a table. But he's speaking about what we could broadly call physical change as a form of ontological alteration in the given reality, one thing being changed by another through a causality exerted upon its being. And Aquinas thinks there are four kinds of what we could call change, philosophical movement or change happening in things. A change can be a change of place, what he calls a local change, like, for example, going from Dublin to Galway. It can be a change in size or shape, change that's quantitative. It can be a change that's qualitative. So, for example, going from hot to cold or from white to yellow or something like that. Or it can be a change that's substantial, the generation or corruption of one being by the activity of another. Now, he also argues that things that change occurs only in things that are because they are in potency to further transformation under the activity, or as he says, actuality of another. To be heated, cold water must be potentially hot. In addition, that things cause change in others happens only insofar as they possess some characteristic that can initiate the process of change. For example, to heat, fire must be actually hot. And must actually be acting on the potency of the water to move or change from the quality of cold to the quality of heat. Okay, so fire being hot is able to impart its heat to cold water to a length of iron. Now, a thing in the process of changing cannot both be in act and in potency under the same aspect or characteristic at the same time. So Aquinas concludes, everything undergoing a process of physical change now, actually, is being changed from potency to act by another agent or others simultaneously acting upon it. And every physical reality in the universe is actually subject to changes either of place, quantity, quality, or generation and corruption due to the actual activities of others. You might say there's no physically pure insular being. Everything that is undergoing one of these four kinds of change under the actual effect of another at any given moment. So at this point, a problem emerges, namely the problem of infinite regress. St. Thomas's point here is straightforward. We should consider physical realities in movement as they actually exist, not as they came to be seen as they came to be historically. What I mean by this is Aquinas is not arguing historically from what he calls per accidens causality. Your parents and mine caused us to be. But we could go back further and ask what caused them to be. We could go all the way back, for example, 4 billion years to the first single cell bacteria. And then we could keep going back and get, maybe if the Big Bang cosmology is absolutely sound, 4 billion years ago, and we could try to argue for a first cause of the Big Bang. This is not what Aquinas is doing. He doesn't think we have any empirical evidence of that sufficient to warrant these kinds of causal arguments. He's only arguing by what he calls, not per accidens, historical sequences of causality that no longer obtain. For example, none of us in this room now actually depend for our existence on our parents. Our parents did cause us to be, but if they are passing now or have passed or, or just be, living somewhere else, they're not causing us to exist as we stand here, right? But he's looking at what he calls essentially order causality, where we are actually dependent right now, for example, on oxygen, temperature, distance from the sun, sets of motions of the earth in regards to the sun, and so forth. And you might say what emerges from that picture is the idea of a vast network or web of simultaneously interdependent physically caused realities, where nothing is purely in act, but everything has potency in it, capacity, you might say, in the order of being, to be changed by others and is being changed by others. But this is true not only of the things that are changing us, of ourselves, or the things we see being changed, but also of the changers. The things acting upon us are themselves being acted upon. And that raises the question of whether you can have not a historical, but an actual, let's say, in the present moment, an actually ordered series of finite causes that are each themselves actually being caused under some aspect of their being by changes exerted upon them in the order of reality by others. And Aquinas argues that you can't simply have an infinite actual chain of moved movers or changed changers. If you appeal to that hypothesis, well, you really don't explain anything, because in every instance of a new, as it were, link in the chain of a reality you point to, you in turn point to something that is actually dependent upon others for its being, and so you need to point then therefore to something else, and that in turn to something else. And all you do is basically pass the buck intellectually in terms of the causal explanations you need to make to something that you've not yet arrived at. If there were not, therefore, a first mover, as he calls it, or a first cause of the changing realities around us that is not itself subject to any movement or change at the as an effect of others, there would not be in the first place any reality subject to change. But we do experience a world of interdependent changing realities. So we need to argue that there's something that is the cause of everything that is subject to change, which is itself not subject to physical alteration of the quantitative, qualitative, locative, or generative and corruptive kind. That's just something that is not a physical reality, and that gives rise to a physical universe of interdependent, actual caused beings that are exerting change upon one another. And that reality is that's his first approach to the existence of God. And it's primarily negative. There's something immaterial, and he says it's pure actuality. It's something that's not subject to physical mutability and alteration. All right, so I had to make that a little shorter, but I did get a kind of first sketch. And I have, I went back through it. I go back through it in the larger paper and look at like how it observes the chains of causal reasoning. And I don't think I have time, but in principle, I wanted to go through the second way, which is shorter. So in the second way in the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas is going to appeal to the causality of existence or being, the very existence of caused things. And I'm going to present this briefly to conclude. Aquinas' second way is also known as the argument from efficient causality. So in the first argument, he talks about this manifest physical change or alteration that occurs in things. And in the second way, he says, I'm going to look at efficient causality. But it's not efficient causality like you and I opening the can, using the can opener to open the can, or driving the car around town. It's efficient causality of a particular sort, the causes of the very existence of things. In order to explain the second way, I'm going to restate it here in terms of Aquinas' famous real distinction between existence and essence in creatures. This is not precisely the way he speaks of it in the argument, but I think it's very closely aligned, his idea about the fact that nothing in the realities we experience, including ourselves, possesses existence by nature, as it were, that we exist simply in virtue of the natural kind of reality that we are. And so I think this kind of thinking about the real distinction between essence and existence in each of us is subjacent to the kind of argument Aquinas makes in the second way. Now, first then, Aquinas maintains that there is in each reality we experience something he calls a real distinction between essence or nature and existence. He doesn't mean there's two things in us walking down the street side by side. He means that there's a composition in us that's ontological. He's also not talking about like chemical composition or material composition. He's talking about something that's got to do with the very structure of our being, you might say formally. Now, we can say this is true of ourselves, that there's some distinction in ourselves between our nature, our essence, and our existence, because no reality we experience could possibly be identical naturally with existence as such. Existence has no definitive kind or essence, no nature among us, because existence is not proper to any one nature. If I say to you, what is existence? You say, it is the lion. The lion is existence. Then all non-lions would fail to exist. But in fact, we see existence is proper to all kinds of diverse natures, physical realities, plants, animals, human beings, aardvarks, stars, cactuses, kangaroos. Therefore, we cannot define or understand existence as an essence or a natural kind, because every nature we experience truly does exist. And clearly, existence in any given thing is not purely identical then with its essence, because the essence is, for example, what makes a kangaroo different than a cactus. But existence is something proper to each of them, in virtue of which we assign each of them a term like being real, having a reality. They both exist. There's a real kangaroo. There's a real cactus. These are not just myths from the deserts of Arizona or Australia. So even if, and at the same time, this existence cause is the source of what you might call the most fundamental ontological ecumenism. Because all these things exist, they have something in common with each other. And yet it isn't their nature that they have in common. So secondly then, no natural reality we experience is the cause of its own existence. Why it exists or why it has its own existence is never due merely to the intrinsic principles of its nature. You might say it's form and matter if you're an Aristotelian. That's to say, form being the kind of thing it is, and the matter, the physical organic body of the thing and its potentiality. I exist truly, of course, because I have a body and a soul, the matter and form of my being. But this raises the question, why do my body and soul exist at all, given that I am a contingent being and have come to exist after having not existed and can cease to exist because I don't exist by nature, or it isn't proper to my nature that I must exist. Existence is for each of us and each thing we experience a kind of gift given to each being from other causes. Each thing we know, including ourselves, comes into being and goes out of being. It does not possess existence simply as a right by nature or due to its essence. Hence, the composition of potency and act in these realities is more radical than the potency and act of being subject to movement. Now we're talking about a potency and act at a deeper level. Each of us has the potency to exist or not exist. We each exist actually, but only as caused by other realities that can exist or not exist themselves. And we came to exist because we had the potency to exist out of other things, and some actual cause caused us to exist. If this is the case then, however, then each being we experience is given existence or comes to exist due to the actual activity of others. For example, I've come into being because I was conceived by my parents. However, my parents in turn also depend for their existence upon others, not just historically, but right now. And so it's similarly the case for all the realities in the universe that we can come to know. There is no, as it were, existentially congenital innocence of any being in the world. They all show up with the trace of derivation. All that exists depends upon another for its cause and can exist or not exist. It does not exist by nature, by essence. Okay, so again we come to the problem of infinite regress. This process of being dependent on others cannot continue indefinitely, for then everything would be receiving its existence or receive its existence from others, but nothing would possess it of itself. Everything would be derived in being, nothing would ever be purely a giver of being. Therefore, there must exist some being for whom existence is necessary, whose nature it is, as it were, to exist. This being does not receive its existence from others, but gives existence to all others, and indeed, this is what we call God. If God exists by nature as one who has existence by virtue of what he is, it's simply, if you happen to be God, then you must exist, because you're the one who gives being to all the rest. Then we must say that in God there is no distinction of existence and essence as we find it in creatures, a distinction according to potency and act, that they can be or not be. It is of God's nature or essence to exist. He is truly, as Exodus 3:14 says, he who is, in a way that can know no diminishment or alteration, characterizes the very essence of God. So, just to recap and conclude, I've looked at a posteriori arguments for the existence of God as a cause of change in changing realities that depend on others as physical realities, and argue that there's some immaterial first cause of reality. And I've argued that the causation of existence and everything that comes into being interpolates us so that we can eventually pass to an a posteriori argument for the necessity of something that exists by nature and gives being to all others. And so we can conclude that there's some kind of non-physical first cause that is pure actuality, that's a necessary reality that exists by nature and is the primary giver of existence to all others. And then one way, this is, if it's true, and of course this is just a postcard version, there are longer, more prolonged investigations, but if this kind of argumentation works, then we've begun already, just with two of the five ways, to generate ways to speak about so-called divine attributes or divine names, like God's perfection, God's eternity, God's simplicity of being. He's not one who receives his being from another, but he simply exists, and so forth. And we could begin to think about God in a structured way. But we should also say, and I think it's absolutely just as important to say, that if this way of thinking in a disciplined approach to God is correct, then we're also aiming to say a great deal about what God is not, and to learn to unthink or unspeak, not speak in ways about God that are too anthropomorphic. This is a philosophical way of talking about God, which makes God, you might say, an obscure mystery. We know that God exists. We also know that God is so transcendent because he's not physical, because he's not caused, that it's very difficult to represent him. We can't represent him sensibly. And it's even difficult for us poor human beings to think about God philosophically, which is in a way a good thing, because it means that this is a philosophy that's not susceptible to intellectual idolatry, anthropomorphism, and projection. And at the same time, I think Aquinas thinks, it makes room for the idea that God could make himself known to us otherwise than through philosophy or through reflection on creation, through God reaching out to us and coming into our domain in some special way through revelation, and perhaps even by becoming human. So with that, I'll finish and, as promised, open the floor to questions. And I'm not prickly about it. If you have questions that want to challenge any aspect of it, of the project, or the whole project as a whole, that's, I'm very happy to talk about it. Thank you.
I'm just curious, at the beginning, or close to the beginning, you said you could use some of these arguments to look at, I guess, kind of more extreme views of philosophy like Nietzsche's.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that? I know that's hard.
No, that's fine. I mean, I wrote the first book, which is a book called Wisdom in the Face of Modernity, is actually looking at the more fundamental challenges I think we experience in our own proximate intellectual culture, which are, I think, not about whether the arguments of existence of God as Aquinas articulates them work, because you never get that far. It's much more about whether there can be even basic metaphysical statements of the kind I'm presuming we can make, that there are things with nature. I keep talking about things having natures and things existing. But Immanuel Kant, in his own way, wants to problematize whether we can even know existence.
And Kant has famously said the pretty clear reason that when I say, for example, that Father Allen exists, all I'm doing is denominating a sensate experience on the horizon of my on the horizon of my sense experience, I'm denominating the location of a particular. So when I say that, for example, you exist, what I'm saying is you appear to me in my senses. And so I don't really have a problem about like explaining the existence of the things around me, because it's just a way of putting a taxonomy on sense experiences. And Kant will say if you do try to do more than that, you're trying to do way too much. You just can't get into these deep principles like essence, existence, actuality, potentiality, causality of substances and their properties. For example, say that I am a substance, meaning in Aristotle's language, it's a funny word, but it means, I'm a holistic, unified entity, and then I have particular properties, like I'm reasonable or I'm capable of playing football or something like that. These are themselves compositions or structures in reality. He's skeptical about. Nietzsche's the intensification of that, because what he wants to argue, in the late notebooks of Nietzsche, he says some very pithy, wonderfully clear things about this, that effectively, in the whole metaphysical project, he thinks, was enunciated primarily in Judeo-Christian, on Judeo-Christian soil academically in the High Middle Ages,
so that we could denote ordinary things around us as existing in relation to a transcendent cause. And once we get rid of, or precisely in a way to get rid of, any reference to transcendent causality, so that we can really be free from the kind of illusions and resentments caused in us by God and the moral structure of reasoning that we've inherited from Judeo-Christianity, we need to get rid of even the language of being. Now, there's a real question about Nietzsche interpretation. I mean, does he really want to do away with ontology? How skeptical is he? In some of the passages, you find him seeming to say, the idea that language should even track onto a set of distinct realities is itself a kind of attempt to master reality. It's illusory. I mean, in other words, one way of reading it is, it's just talking about reality philosophically is just art. And basically, it's the construction of worldviews. And it's play. And so this gravity we have to think, he makes fun of scientists. He says, we want to explain the world through modern science. And he thinks similarly in metaphysicians and certainly clergy. People want to kind of give the world this serious meaning and invest it with explanatory properties. They've missed the whole point. We should be artistically playing with the construction of meaning through each narrating our own reality. Now, there's another way to read him. Both these readings, by the way, are proposed in different ways by Heidegger. There's a whole other way of reading Nietzsche in Heidegger that does see him as the kind of destructor of an old regime of ontology and the founder of a new regime of ontology, which is a lot less explanatory and rational and more intuitive and affective. And that's where you get kind of the rebirth of the sacred in the late writings of Heidegger. And can we think about God as the ground of being in a maybe a non-personal way, with things like the Greco-Roman myths as inspiration? But if you look at that project, like late Heidegger's writings that take some inspiration from Nietzsche, it's not clear how reasonable it is. I mean, it's more like almost like a poetic conception of reality. And I think in some ways both of these wings of interpretation, and I'm sure there's others, are really to, in a way, I would see them as projects of, on the one hand, characterized by intellectual despair, where we can't really explain the world, and on the other hand, by an attempt to pass from philosophy as the primary way to think about reality to poetry. And then say, like, basically the artistic license in poetry, the poetic license of each human being to paint the world having meaning is the sort of central project of human existence. And I think you see that in Jean-Paul Sartre as a very good interpreter, with the idea of kind of independent world construction, construing the meaning of your own life. And of course we have a lot of that around us in our culture today. But how do you have a conversation with that kind of thing? I think actually the sciences are actually a friend here for an Aristotelian, that I am an Aristotelian, more a friend than a foe, because they allow us to see how the sort of reality of the body and of nature and the ethical imperatives of nature, including ecological imperatives, but also moral imperatives about the human body and its integrity, open us up to thinking about human dignity, human identity, and essence. So that's one thing. And I think another thing is that there's no concept of friendship in Nietzsche. And I think human beings can't be happy without friends. And I think if you start to see what friendship entails, it entails knowledge of the nature of another person. And so I think a world without natures is a world without friendship, and that's an unbearable world. And so I think Nietzsche's just takes us to very dark places there.
What would you say to people who, from either a theistic or an atheistic position, kind of disparage the whole project of trying to determine the existence of God through philosophy? They kind of say, Aquinas says this, and then Hume responds with this, and then somebody responds to Hume, and kind of this seems like it's a dog chasing its tail eternally over the course of hundreds of years, but
yeah.
It seems like very, very smart people are disagreeing with each other fundamentally.
They do, among the most clever. I mean, that's, I think what's so tragic about Hume is he's used all the brilliance of his intellect to sequester himself in a skeptical stance, a guarded stance where he will not allow himself, I think, sufficiently to investigate reality. So what I would say is, there's actually two kinds of people that are very different that one talks to here from a Thomist point of view. One are theologians who despair of the capacity of human reason to reach any kind of conclusive knowledge of God.
And there you have someone like Karl Barth. I edited a volume called The Analogy of Being, which has a lot of interesting engagements between Barthians and non-Barthians on this question of whether theology needs metaphysics. I'm giving a talk on this very same subject tomorrow night at Oxford, and it's a continual interest of mine, because I think we can't really think deeply about the Trinity or about the Incarnation or about the human being and grace without some philosophical references. And I think when people claim that they don't, that they're doing theology without philosophy, they're typically smuggling in some kind of philosophy, whether knowingly or unknowingly, and it's having some determinant effect on the shape of their theology. And I don't think, I think it's true of Barth and his Trinitarian theology, which is deeply influenced by various aspects of 19th century German idealism that are philosophical, but I think not sufficiently vetted by philosophers and by theologians using philosophy. That said, that being said, I have a great kind of admiration for the Barthian project. And in a world where people do despair of natural knowledge of God and think this stuff's all interminable and unresolvable, you can understand somebody saying it's all resolved only by divine revelation. You're either in the light or you're in the darkness. And I think that for an atheist or an agnostic could be a very tempting view, because we're befuddled in a kind of Pascalian way. So we're befuddled by the fact that we have like enough light that the world seems orderly enough that there's a project of seeking intelligibility, but it's exhausting and I can't get there. I think the middle position on this is McIntyre's position in Three Rival Versions of Moral Inquiry, where he argues that it is hard to think it out on your own. It's crazy to try to think it all out on your own. What you need are wise teachers and to be in a good and solid tradition. But you need to choose your traditions well. You need to test traditions against their various critics. With regards to atheists, I think the real conversation, I mean, I'm talking about principled atheists, or let's just say principled agnostics, who think that agnosticism is a very healthy stand. Intellectual reserve is best in the face of competing forms of atheistic and religious fanaticism, or, you know, potentially dangerous ideology. I think with all these kinds of people, the intellectual ecumenism we should be seeking is actually that denoted by what the Christian philosophers in the Middle Ages called the search for the truth regarding the transcendentals. That's to say, I think we should have some humble and real search for the structures of being in our life. It's not too much to ask people to acknowledge that, for example, everyone in this room is a distinct existence. And yes, maybe each of us is just a bundle of atoms, and that's all we are, but asking that question, trying to get out the answer to it, seems like the right kind of question to be pursuing together as atheists and religious people. The question of the truth and the human being's dignity is a subject that is an agent of truth for our common culture, that we should be held responsible for telling the truth and not lying. And then goodness, because I think the Gorgias, the argument of the Gorgias of Plato remains normative. We cannot have a common human culture without justice. And so we have substantive disagreements about justice, but we have to be concerned about what is good and what is just. And beauty. You know, I think we should be concerned about having a culture of beauty and not just a culture of utility and functionality, and a culture of aesthetics that dignifies the human person rather than debasing them and making them part of some terrible, purely efficient system. You know, so I think the questions of what is the case with regards to being, truth, goodness, and beauty are ecumenical questions of the intellect that allow us to reach out in a non-threatening way and invite people who are of a decidedly agnostic or atheistic turn of mind to come into a deep conversation with Christianity without immediately having to resolve for or against questions of ultimate causality with regard to God. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I was just struck by something you said towards the end. You referred to the DDS, Brighton's doctrine of divine simplicity, as helping us combating idolatry. Can you please say a little more about that, please?
Well, the idea of conceptual idolatry is a trope in modern theology. You find sometimes, for example, in Barthians who are worried that all metaphysics is the source of conceptual idolatry. That behind Barth, you have Feuerbach, who's concerned that we can not just paint pictures of the deity or create statues that are anthropomorphic, but also, more dangerously perhaps, create vast systems of ideological construction that conceal the mystery of God or the absolute as much as even while seeking to make it manifest. Right? So, I mean, in a certain way, what's the most dangerous thing possible?
in terms of harming us in our relationship with the mystery of God is philosophy and theology. I mean, atheism's, you know, got its problems, but what about theologians? I mean, they could create all kinds of vast networks and systems of thinking about God that could be actually concealing from us knowledge about religious traditions that are erroneous, all that kind of thing. But you also have it in, like, Jean-Luc Marion's thinking about...
in his famous book, God Without Meaning, who wants to think about... he's a Catholic philosopher, obviously, French. He wants to
explore ways we can talk about God as the giver of being, or the giver of the gift of existence, without trying to set up a network. He's a Heideggerian, without setting up a network of explanations premised on classical metaphysics. These people are all allergic to, as it were, God reduced to a conceptual explanation that I've mastered, and it makes God extremely uninteresting, all too conceivable God that's absolutely unbelievable, or literally non-credible, incredible. Right, that's, I think, a concern. Now, what Aquinas, I think, you know, so a lot of people think, because Aquinas is sophisticated, and, you know, I'm not really adequate to expositing his sophistication. But when you read Aquinas, you know, some people worry that that's what's going on. But I think when you see what exactly does in the next question on simplicity, it's all about talking about how God is not like creatures, and therefore not conceivable. He is literally inconceivable for us under the registers of created being. That doesn't mean we can't think about God in a disciplined way, but the more we do, the more we have to start by beginning by saying what he isn't. He isn't a body. There's no representations of him. He can't be conceived under bodily notions. He doesn't have, he's not one in a series of those who have a common nature. So like there are many, many reindeer, or many, many trees, or many, many human beings, but there aren't many gods, and God is just one God among them. Right? So that's totally different. Everything we know is a being in a series of like kinds. That's not a case of God. He's also not a being that has his being from another. So that means he's utterly unthinkable in terms of causal origination. Right? So that, you know, there are like massive ways that you have to unlearn it as you're learning to think about God. And that's a spiritual discipline of approaching God spiritually with your mind. I mean, so these disjunctions we think about, like there's philosophy of God, then there's spirituality, and then there's theology. Aquinas, in a way, has these deep convergences. Like you're learning to think spiritually about God. You're learning to be a spiritual person by learning to think about God as one who is unknown to you, unless he wants to make himself known to you. And this enters deeply into his Trinitarian theology and his theology of the Incarnation. Because then in those mysteries, God discloses himself to us on God's terms. So there's an interesting sort of set of spiritual disciplines that go with this way of thinking.
Interesting, thank you.
Yeah.
What makes Aquinas' five words exclusive to the Christian notion of God and not another kind?
That's a good question. That's a deeply disputed... So first of all, Aquinas has about 15 different arguments for the existence of God. And the five ways are summary, actually brief. He gives all of them. The five ways are all given in other places in his corpus, pretty much, in usually longer versions. Okay, so the point is that Aquinas wrote other stuff. But when you talk about what he's doing in these particular five arguments, there are a lot of arguments among his most faithful interpreters about what you actually conclude to. So, for example, some people think the first way only gets you to something that's not physical, but not to the Creator. And then a lot of people think the second way does get you to a creator. Some people deny that. Okay, so, you know, the thing is also, there's deep influence from Aristotle, but Aristotle doesn't think of God as creator in at anything like the way, say, Augustine does, or the great medieval philosophers and theologians, as an efficient cause who gives being and sustains in being all things. There's also influence from Avicenna, in the third way, and Avicenna is himself influenced by not only Aristotle but also the Quran, and through the Quran and Neoplatonism as well, you know, Greco-Roman Neoplatonism. So there's a lot of non-Christian thought coming into the five ways, and Aquinas is very aware of that and thinks that that's a sign that our intellect can naturally approach God, and we find, you know, pathways towards the truth in non-Christian religious traditions. He also says, though, that the Christian revelation helps clarify and purify and strengthens and helps us go faster with regards to natural knowledge of God. So, for example, he says it's in principle possible for a philosopher to demonstrate that God is omnipotent. But it's only because in the Judeo-Christian revelation we see God performing miracles that the Christian philosophers thought more deeply about what omnipotence is. Likewise, he argues in the Summa Cum Gentiles that you can say rigorously as a philosopher that God is love. This is different than the belief in the Holy Spirit or the grace of love that comes from God's charity poured into our hearts by grace. But he thinks you can say something about God being love, but he knows quite well that no non-Christian philosopher has really argued for this. So he does have a kind of delicate conception of what you might call Christian philosophy, which is philosophy, but influenced by the external, you might say, influences of grace upon the philosopher as Christian, going further. And this is a hugely disputed question. Like Etienne Gilson thinks that basically all of Aquinas is writing about God philosophically is fundamentally grounded in the revelation of his reflection on the revelation of Exodus 3:14. I am he who is, and God has given being. The revelation of the Creator in Exodus is like stands behind all of the Christian philosophical reasoning. And other people, like he had a great debate with Van Steenbergen, who was a priest in Leuven in the 30s and 40s of the last century, who argued, no, look, these are philosophical arguments. They just stand or fall on their own. And I hold a middle position that's a position like that of Jacques Maritain, which is that Christian revelation does deeply influence our intellectual life, but Aquinas is taking a lot of philosophical arguments from non-Christian religious traditions and from previous Christian philosophers and working through them as a philosopher, but a philosopher who's very aware of of other things he knows about God from Christian revelation. And he's bringing faith and reason into deep harmony. So it's a both, it's a very deeply both and. I think he's really a good philosopher, qua philosopher. He's also very aware of the theological influences. And that question itself of how to interpret Aquinas is rather fascinating. And a subject that can get people very heated, actually, in the inside baseball of Thomism. Why don't I liberate you since you've been so patient. But if any of you want to stay and ask a few more questions, I'm happy to do so. And I think also there's something at the chaplaincy.
Yes.
Where conversation will continue. Thank you.